Hey CNFers, promotional support is provided by Hippocampus Magazine. Its 2018 Remember in November contest for creative nonfiction is open for submissions until July 15th. This annual contest has a grand prize of $1,000 and publication for all finalists. That's awesome. Visit HippocampusMagazine.com for details. Hippocampus Magazine. Memorable, creative nonfiction. Hey, we're back in the saddle again. I took a week off from producing a show, much to the chagrin of the wife, who thought it was a bad move to miss a week, but I had two hard deadlines, a long feature and a long column, and our dog is in rough shape these days, so it's incredibly hard to focus. On top of that, I got some great feedback on this book I've been writing since 2009, and it's the kind of feedback that is incredibly valuable, smart, and incisive, but it's made me realize just how shitty I am at this. I'm paying a significant amount of our GDP to become a better writer and editor myself throughout this whole process, but it's a continuing ed thing as much as trying to get my stupid book published. Okay. So I'm probably less shitty than I was 10 years ago, but I'm still, like, wicked shitty. 10 years from now, I'll be less shitty than I am today. And all the people I've disappointed along the way will likely be dead. So there's that. So, what is the show? It's the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. You know, that's the show where I speak to artists about telling true stories. Today's guest for episode 103 is Dennis Overby, at Overby on Twitter. O-V-E-R-B-Y-E. He's a science writer for the New York Times. He's also a Pulitzer Prize finalist and author of two books, Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos, The Story of the Scientific Quest for the Secrets of the Universe, and Einstein in Love, A Scientific Romance. That's fun. I'd love it if you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and share episodes across your social streams with people you think you might get some value from the interview. You are the social network. I algorithm you. That's it, friends. Here's Dennis Overby, episode 103.
The day that we were actually supposed to speak several weeks ago was the day that Stephen Hawking passed, and I suspect that that is about as hectic a day as you get on the cosmic beat. So what was that day like as the news hit you and then you had to craft, you know, these very long obituaries and also a really fine essay about what Stephen Hawking taught us about life?
Right. Well, it was, of course, I found out at midnight and it had been a bad day and I didn't sleep that night. Now, luckily, it's no secret that we prepare advance obituaries of important people. So I'd actually written Hawking's obituary about three or four times before. So that was pretty much ready to go. But I knew that, in fact, by the time I got in the next morning, it had already been posted online, but I did have to write that essay, which I had sort of thought about. I mean, I'd been thinking about this 3 years, and then I thought, well, this is never going to happen, and then it did, so it was a terrible blow. I'm still trying to come to grips with it, because I spent a lot of my career writing about Hawking. I started out writing about Hawking 40 years ago.
Right.
I followed him, really, through the decades, and seen this become such a phenomenon that, you know, it's still hard for me to believe. That's hard for me. Even he's gone.
Yeah. What was your first interactions with him in your first chance meetings back in the 70s?
Well, I saw him rolling through the ballroom of the Copley Plaza in Boston at a meeting, and I thought, oh, this is just one of the most dramatic things I've ever seen. And he was there to give a talk about his recent discovery that black holes would explode and what that meant for the universe. And it was very deep and very moving. I'm like, oh, wow, this is like, in some ways I felt like I'd always known him, but of course I didn't.
Right.
But I got to know him a little bit, and then I went to England later on and spent some time with him.
Yeah, I suspect that meeting him and then being lucky and blessed enough to be able to follow him and have him be a key figure of your first book, that it must have been like what people experienced in the 20s and 30s when they brushed shoulders with Einstein, someone who was really on the cusp of innovation and just expanding what we knew and really changing the way we understand or think about the universe. So did you in those moments realize that you were experiencing something that might only come around every 50 to 100 years?
I think as a writer, you recognize when an extraordinary story, an extraordinary character walks into your life, and you want to make the most of it. So I've been lucky enough to have that happen a few times, and Hawking was one of them. You get to be in the right place at the right time.
So getting back to maybe a little bit of your origin, Dennis, what was your early start and your early love for covering science writing, and then specifically getting put on to, say, getting on the coolest beat of all time, which is just covering the universe?
Got a job as the assistant typesetter at Sky and Telescope magazine for $6 an hour. After writing a letter to every publisher in the Boston Yellow Pages, pleading for a job.
Who might have been those writers, say, in the sci-fi genre that were sufficiently exciting to you, and then you decided to then sort of maybe merge that exciting language with the nonfiction elements of covering the cosmic beat? So who were some of those early influences for you?
In terms of science fiction, it's the kind of the trinity of Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Heinlein, and Isaac Asimov. I think probably Clarke especially, because I actually met him, and one of my most valued possessions is framed in my office, actually, is a letter he wrote about Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos after he read it.
What is it? Can you recall off the top of your head what that letter says?
Well, so Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos is sort of a kind of a history of recent cosmology, and the people who kind of first happened on the idea of the Big Bang and the expanding universe and Palomar telescope. And Clarke knew all these guys, so he read the book and he said it reminded him of his old days visiting Palomar and the people he met. He thought I captured them well. We have some technical disagreements, but he had some wild ideas. But it was fun, except he didn't like the title.
Uh-huh.
He thought the title was off-putting.
Huh. With the positive things that he said about it was that, as any writer can attest to, having someone validate a particular artistic endeavor can put a lot of fuel in the tank. So, getting that letter from someone that you revered from your early reading, what did that do to you as a writer? Did it just kind of fill your blood with a lot more energy, and how long did that last?
Well, like I said, I framed it and it's hanging on the wall in my study, along with award plaques and things like that, because it's another kind of award, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think it at that point had any effect on my, made me feel good, but didn't have any effect on my career aspirations or anything like that.
So when you were in ninth grade, I read from your bio, you got kicked off the newspaper, and it took you.
All right, I've forgotten what parts of the story you're familiar with and what. I was in after school without permission in a room in which an eraser was thrown.
Just one.
Just one racer. I don't know. I mean, the other thing was that I had, which I kind of forgot, and I kind of remembered that I had also written a letter pretty much accusing the principal of lying to that student. He didn't like that either, and that actually that editorial never ran. So that was the end of my journalism career for 20 years, and I got more interested in science. I mean, I'd already been reading lots of science fiction anyway.
Yeah, so yeah, degree in physics from MIT, that'll get you in the door in terms of very high level, high concept science. So how did that inform the reporting that you would later do after that?
Well, it didn't actually. And what, you know, I would show you my MIT transcript, which is like embarrasses my daughter when I discuss it because it was pretty bad. What it did give me with sort of background in fundamentals and the kind of language, and you know, I can melt into the crowd.
Yeah, it allows you to at least ask a question that doesn't seem totally inane, and then you can get the real, like, dirty information, good, dirty, muddy information from the real experts. But like, that kind of gets you in the door, doesn't it?
You know, I'm familiar with the landscape, so I'm comfortable around scientists, and they just regard me as part of their furniture. You know, at least before I joined the Times. Now with the Times, it's different because there's a light shining on you. Even if everything's all off the record, they still don't want to say certain things because they're just so they're so terrified of the Times.
Huh.
Like I can say things in books or magazine articles, and but I can't get away with saying in the New York Times because it's so prominent. And then I realized the only thing I've learned is that a lot of the people that I write about, I've known for a long time, and I met them when they were young, they're starting their careers, they're postdocs or something. They're all senior professors and presidents of professional societies and Nobel Prize winners, and they have their words carry more weight than they used to.
Mm. And what was so that's it's great in a sense that when you were coming up covering cosmology and the universe that so many of these people were kind of almost you know, paralleled you in age. So you guys were kind of just kind of growing and developing in your careers together. It wasn't like you were a, you know, maybe a 25-year-old cub reporter covering a 60-year-old, you know, tenured professor, president of whatever society. So it must have been kind of neat to see almost the entire arc of a career play out before you, I imagine.
Yes, although in my mind, I'm still a 25-year-old cub reporter.
right. And that's got to be key to sort of maintain that hunger and hustle of a young reporter, but imbued with all the experience you've had over the last 40 years.
I guess you could put it that way. I don't feel it that way.
So how? In terms of getting access to the people that you want to write about, and it appears to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, like a fairly cloistered and very tight knit and almost very small and provincial, you know, people who are doing this kind of research. So how have you been able to engender trust and get access to these people so you can write about it as eloquently as you do?
So some of it is just because I've known people a long time, and when I started out, I had this credential of working for this guy in Telescope, which was like regarded as a serious, respectable outlet, as opposed to the New York Times. And so people let me in and they talk to me and they just keep talking to me. And now the New York Times. So it's me or maybe it's the New York Times. But I always get my calls return, but I don't know if it's because it's me, Dennis Overby, or it's the New York Times. Maybe it's a combination of both. the access kind of comes with it.
Yeah, and what strikes you? What is the most exciting part of what you cover? Like, what fascinates you the most? And you know, what are some of those things that you're tapped into that you know just that really excite you? And when you get the chance to write about it, it really you know that kind of spark ignites.
I mean, what interests me really are sort of questions that don't have answers. So
yeah, which seems to be much of cosmology. It's the more each answer seems to spark five or a dozen more questions.
So I guess, I mean, the fact that we're really ignorant of everything important about the universe and ourselves is fascinating. And we should bask in it because it makes us humble and it makes us curious and it drives us ahead.
Yeah, and when I was reading the Kilonova story you wrote, and then prior to that, other people who were, and I'm sure you were covering it too, with the gravitational wave of those two black holes colliding, and that little blip they hear at the LIGO stations, and I wonder, in your experience of speaking with these scientists and researchers, it really just happened to be. Lucky that they had the technology and the equipment to catch these chirps at the right time. And have any of them expressed any degree of regret? Might be the wrong word, but do they feel anxious about what they might be missing because they don't have the technology right now to register what data might be out there going unregistered? Does that make any sense? Or do they just not think about it?
Too much time worrying about signals they didn't see. They're busy getting ready to, they're improving the LIGO antennas right now so that they can see deeper and they can see more. So, I mean, it's a field that's driven by optimism and not regret. I think, luck had nothing to do with it. It took 40 years and $1 billion. I mean,
yeah.
I toured one of these facilities last week, and it's just mind-bendingly complex. It's so complicated. If you ask me if you'd set out things that we have to do in order to make this work, I would have just run screaming. Eastern Washington, they have to compensate for earthquakes in Alaska and the tides out on the Pacific coast and birds pecking on nitrogen tanks nearby, and mice that get into their tunnels, and the mice poop makes little pinholes in their vacuum tubes. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
But they have to put up with it. It's staggering. And so it wasn't luck. It was hard work and determination and,
yeah, I guess maybe what I'm thinking in terms of luck is just the timing of the windows. Because I think in the Kilonova story, someone said it was only like a couple weeks ago prior to them hearing that signal that the two neutron stars collided, that they were even able to register it or something. Maybe I'm reading that. Maybe I read that wrong. But yeah, I don't discount the work and the rigor and my God, the microscopic attention to detail that. These things to register these things that happen billions of light years.
I think the Kilonova one. The key to it was that this third detector had come online in Italy, and so there are now three. And the fact that detector didn't see it or got a very weak signal because it was in a part of the sky where that detector had little sensitivity, and they were able to. Sort of combine that information from the three detectors and really localize the signal, which allowed the astronomers to find it. And then they went to town, and it was like 4,000, half the world's astronomers got in on the action.
Huh.
It was lucky. So the first collision that they found was, that was kind of lucky because they were just turning the thing on and it's new, but they actually call it advanced LIGO. And they actually hadn't even started their official observing run. This thing happened. It was kind of like if you're going fishing and you pull up by the stream and there's this nice looking fishing hole there and you drop a line in and bam, you get a strike right away. Then you think, wow, this is a good spot. You might spend the rest of the day that same hole and not get another strike. None of the astronomers or physicists I've talked to were surprised that gravitational waves exist, but it was a surprise that the first thing they saw were big black holes colliding, because they had expected to see neutron stars colliding. Those were the specs that they built this thing to, because nobody knew black holes would collide.
It was so Einstein had hypothesized that, but then, yeah, they didn't have the data, right?
Einstein's theory suggested that black holes should exist. Einstein didn't like them. He didn't like the idea. Nobody knew if they would actually be colliding. But that was exciting because it's just, there's all this stuff going on out there in the darkness and the void that now, we may maybe be able to detect, what kinds of other strange vibrations are out there that we've never even thought about. The excitement about LIGO, less than gravitational waves existed, more than we're going to tune into this whole other level of the universe that we haven't had.
Yeah, I heard an interesting conversation on the Design Matters podcast with Debbie Millman, and she was interviewing, I believe his name is David Spiegel. I think that's his name, but I'm sorry?
It is Spergel.
Spergel. That's it. And about his career, I'm sure he's someone you're very familiar with in the course of your career. And he was able to take that sort of baby picture of the universe from the 300,000 years out from the Big Bang or something, which is very infancy. So it's listening to that and then, the vast, dark energy and all this stuff. And I wonder how you as a reporter of this stuff kind of get your head around it, because it is, like you were saying earlier, a lot of the stuff is very mind bendy. So how do you ground it and try to make sense of it and then convey that to a reader?
Well, nobody ever asked me that before. None of it makes any sense, right? The universe doesn't make much sense. We don't know what dark energy is, and we don't know what dark matter is. And I guess it doesn't, I don't have trouble bending my head around it, because I spent too much time reading Arthur C. Clarke when I was a kid, and I expect all this stuff to be strange and wondrous.
Is it getting to your routine and the way you approach the writing and so forth? I wonder how you set up your day and what your morning routine might be as you're looking to get into, warm up the engine, so to speak, and get to the work you do. And this might be, apply more to when you're doing more long form stuff, magazine stuff, or even book work. So if you're in that mode, how are you setting up your days? What time are you waking up so you can start, you can hit the day and feel like you are accomplishing something of merit for that day?
Well, so I wake up at 6 o'clock, and my daughter wakes up a little bit after that, and I see that she gets out the door. I'll go out the door with her, and I go to the gym. And sometimes I have my best ideas of the day then on the rowing machine at the gym. I mean, in some ways, every day is the same, and every day is different. I mean, if I'm working on some long article, I am kind of obsessed with it, and I'm thinking about it all the time.
And do you say a lot of your best ideas happen at the gym sometimes? So do you have a way of a system of keeping track of these ideas so you can harvest them later?
No, it's just my brain. I mean, I never stop thinking about it. So if I have a good idea, it usually sticks around.
Yeah, like that's your metric of a good idea. Like if I don't forget this idea, then this is something worth pursuing. If I forget it, it probably wasn't that good in the first place, for at least for your taste.
Because it often happens that when you actually then sit down to write it down. Somehow the sentence just doesn't work, or it never, you realize that you didn't actually only conceive half of it or something. And that's sort of frustrating. Sometimes you think you have a good idea and it doesn't go anywhere for you.
Mm. So, and then when you're working on longer stuff, book length narrative, long narratives, and you're beyond that initial honeymoon phase of thinking that the idea is great and, you know, and you love it and you're in love with it. But then you get to the ugly middle of the draft. How do you handle the ugly grind in that section when you're too far away to turn home and you're very far away from the end? Yeah, how do you just muscle through that part?
So, well, when I was writing my books, I felt like I was coming swimming across the Atlantic. And so at some point, you've lost sight of land behind you and you haven't seen land ahead of you and you just sort of going. So I hate it. I mean, I hate it. I love the problem at the same time. You know, it's kind of a contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's that hard for you, maybe it's going to be that hard for the reader too. And you should be doing something. You should be doing something differently.
So how do you approach your research and then organize your notes?
You're giving me credit for a lot more organization than I have.
Yeah. If you saw my desk, we'd probably be kindred spirits, but
I mean, in general, less over a big project. I mean, you just start out with a list of people and you talk to them and then you talk to the people that they thought you should talk to. And you just keep going. You just keep stepping through all these people. And sooner or later, their stories converge. And then I feel like I'm actually sort of getting someplace and I have a story to tell. I guess the best example of this lately was the Higgs boson. I did spend 6 months trying to recreate what actually happened, how they found it. And, you know, there are 3,000, there are two teams of 3,000 people each and can't talk to 6,000 people.
Hmm.
Story. But you can talk to a lot of people and they all had kind of different views of the thing. But eventually, when the stories start echoing each other, then I felt like I kind of honed in on the main narrative.
I see. And which story was this?
Oh, so this is it was called Chasing the Higgs. It was the entire Science Times section a few years ago. And started the whole search for the Higgs boson and, you know, who was involved and the two teams and how they, the false leads and the rumors and how it finally came into view and what we call TikTok.
And what do you mean? What do you mean by TikTok? You know, pardon my ignorance.
Go back and reconstruct what actually happened behind the scenes of some work event, like who actually said what to whom, when, and why. You know, what did they do? What was going on?
Gotcha.
That was my TikTok of the discovery of the Higgs bosons. So that was the Pulitzer finalist, and that was just a massive amount of reporting. You just, you know, report it out. You just keep talking to more people and asking more questions. I had this fantasy that someplace there was some postdoc or graduate student who had first seen a little bump on a graph and that was the boson, and I could find that person in the first sock. And I think I did, but she didn't really want to be. And the teams have this philosophy that they're all in it together and nobody should get any individual credit because everybody has a different job to do. And it's sort of not fair. The people who like built the detectors and, you know, spent months down in the hole in CERN, you know, wiring things together. And then some years later, some young kids looking at a computer program would like do the final analysis and say, oh, there it is. Those people came in at the end and ran the software, didn't work any more important than the people that built the thing years ago. So they should all get equal credit. So they didn't like having individual people singled out. wouldn't actually say like who actually drafted the final report. I mean, they just signed by everybody, but clearly 3,000 people did write the paper. A committee of people write the paper, and a few people who most interested, but they were not allowed to be identified. So you're fighting that tendency. If you want to know what's happening behind the scenes, they have a philosophical problem with that.
When you're working on a long piece of this nature, do you outline your work? Do you use corkboards, flashcards? Like, how do you go about that degree of organization and structure, or do you just fly by the seat of your pants?
Well, let's see. I don't know. So it's been different. I can't remember what I did with the Higgs. I tend to want to organize things in a narration chronologically. When I did the Einstein book, I actually constructed this file on my computer, and every quote, every factoid that I gleaned about Einstein, I put in this big document in chronological order. It had as many pages as the final book.
And when you're writing the book, you've got your notes and anything, like on a given day, how long, what's your endurance like for the writing? How long can you go before you need to just stop for the day or just take breaks? You know, what does that look like as you're getting into that real generative phase of a project?
Well, so that, when I'm in that mode, I would start first thing in the morning, then I'd go eat breakfast, then I'd come back, and I'd wear out about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then I'd start thinking about dinner.
And do you measure those days often by a word count or just sheer hours in the chair?
Certainly not by word count. Maybe just my own sense of am I progressing through this narrative or not. I mean, if it's a book, so it's broken up in chapters, and you have a chapter outline, so it's kind of exciting to get to the end of a chapter. That's cool. I can go on to the next thing. It'll post for yourself. Anything, yeah, in a large, large newspaper piece, the same way. Divide it up in subdivisions and get one section done. You feel good. You go home. Then you face the horrible dilemma of starting over again the next day.
Right.
You never feel good for very long.
Right. Or in some cases, feel good at all. I'm always interested in how writers fight off loneliness and self-doubt. So I'd extend that question to you too, especially in the throes of a long project. That how do you fend off those feelings of loneliness and self-doubt?
Well, they're always there, but you have to. It's better to produce something than to not produce something.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of gotten to that point about it. I do worry. I mean, every time I write, I'll be there. My editor is actually going to like this, or it's really just not as good as what I was doing before. Somewhere along the way, I developed the attitude that, okay, I'm allowed to have one. I'm allowed to have an off day, right?
Of course.
And so I just, I give myself permission. Probably less lonely now than when I was writing books and I was alone. I was living alone.
Mm-hmm.
It was, now I'm in a different environment. If you're writing a book, you're off. You don't know if the world cares about you, if the world still remembers you're there. I don't worry about the world not knowing I'm here. And my editor sits literally 6 feet away from me. Like I can't disappear.
And an interesting conversation I was having with a baseball coach, actually, for the show. He's he had written this book about finding clarity, about hitting and finding purpose. And so when the guys step up to the plate, they have clear vision of what they need to do. And And we were talking about strengths and weaknesses. And oftentimes we're told, well, no matter what the discipline, to you have your strengths, but you should try to level up your weaknesses. And he was arguing that really, you know, especially in the major leagues, it's just like you're good at one thing, one or two things. Actually, you should be leaning into your strengths and mitigating weaknesses, but not leveling them up so much, because otherwise the average of your strengths and weaknesses will then just kind of muddy, and you'll end up being sort of jack of all trades, master of none, so to speak. And in this line of work, I wonder what you would identify as your strengths and weaknesses, and whether you sort of buy into that leaning into the strength versus trying to level up weaknesses. I'm kind of interested in how writers and artists process that.
I guess if I have strengths, it might be, you know, metaphors. Probably my weakness is fact-checking.
Mm-hmm.
I always have to, because I just don't want to keep doing like the same thing over and over again. So I could be better at that.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, in reading your work, especially that part that I read before we were officially recording, and I'll just read it again now, just so listeners would hear it. It said, this is in your Killanova story, and it's just this wonderful sentence that starts, "All the atoms in your wedding band and the Pharaoh's treasures and the bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and still threaten us all, so the story goes, have been formed in cosmic gong shows that reverberated across the heavens." And I think just the way you were able to take this weird cosmic event that happened, you know, just countless light years away, and then you say, you know, the metals in your wedding band and then the Pharaoh's treasures, all of a sudden you took something way out there and brought it right down to Earth. And so, like, is that kind of what you're getting at in terms of what you think that you're particularly good at?
Yeah, I think that's probably what people think I'm good at, mixing the cosmic and the personal, one book reviewer said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the only way for people to get their head around this kind of stuff in a lot of ways. It's like you really do have to pull that thread from way the hell out there and get it down into something concrete and be like, oh, wow. So when those neutron stars slammed into each other, like, that made gold that, you know, billions and billions of years later is what was forged on my hand and is the symbol of eternity, so to speak.
Right. Well, that's what you owe people, because, I mean, people don't need to know the details of nucleosynthesis or whatever, but you owe them kind of a sense of what it's like to be in the universe. If you can convey that, you've done your job, because it's their universe. It's not just Einstein's universe. This is the only one we have, I think. Maybe not. There might be other universes, but we can't go there. So this is it.
Well, it's like that great Carl Sagan quote he said something to the effect that, you know, we're all made of star stuff. Yeah. And that's kind of a cool way to tie in the cosmos and then bring it back into the heart in a way.
Well, it's literally true.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's very freaky if you really try to think about it and what that means.
In terms of your nonfiction, you referred to some of those great iconic science fiction writers when you were coming up. In terms of maybe some nonfiction, what were some maybe like 3 to 5 books, if you can remember them off the top of your head, that were very influential for you in terms of the work you do and maybe even the style you've adopted over the years?
So I should mention Timothy Ferris, who's a friend of mine and you know, was into this whole business before I was. When I read his work, I was very impressed, and I probably saw, yeah, you can write about this stuff poetically. When I wrote Lonely Hearts, I was two things that I was trying to follow was one was the The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe. Mm-hmm. And the other one was The Snow Leopard by Peter Matheson. And those books affected me a lot.
What was it about Wolfe and Matheson's approach to those books that struck a chord with you?
Well, it's easier to talk about Wolfe because I remember the book better than I do The Snow Leopard, but it was, he's a great writer, and he took something you thought you knew about the astronauts and realized you didn't know anything about the astronauts, and put you into their heads in a way that nobody had done. And I thought, I'm going to do that with the cosmologists.
Yeah, that's it goes to the immense patience it takes, and then just the willingness to sit back and, like you said earlier, just kind of become a piece of furniture in the room. That allows you to be sort of be more like an anthropologist and kind of recede into the background, and then you can empathically get into people's heads over time. And just like in Wolfe's book, and I suspect with your work, that's kind of what you need to get at to really ground some of this really abstract stuff.
Well, it's not magic. It's a lot of work. I mean, you've got to do a lot of interviewing. You've got to find out.
Yeah.
You can't intuit what is in people's heads. They'll tell you if you ask them.
A lot of times when you do this kind of stuff, you have to ask what seems like really inane and boring questions. But if you don't ask them, then you don't really know what's going on in someone's head or what they were thinking at a certain time. Do you have any experiences of getting some pushback from anybody who just kind of rolls their eyes, be like, "Man, Dennis, why are you asking me this?" This is.
I've had many moments like that. You just have to endure it. It's your job. It's your job to be there and ask the questions. And you have to ask stupid questions. Especially, you have to ask stupid questions. In my case, because I know a fair amount of background, I have to remember that I'm there for the reader. I'm not there for me. And so I have to remember to ask the questions that readers might ask. And sometimes you get surprising answers. And the other thing is, if you ask them to, you can get them to do a lot of the work for you. You ask them to, how does this work? And sometimes they'll give you a nice metaphor or something like that. You can take and run with it. And then they can't complain because it's something they made up themselves.
Right. And given how technical a lot of this reporting and jargon can be, do you conduct your interviews with a voice recorder to make sure you're getting every little nuance and even the way syllables and everything are pronounced and the words exactly right? Or do you rely just kind of old school notebook and scribbling?
So, when I did Lonely Hearts, I did do a whole series of interviews with one guy, Alan Sandage, who was practically invented cosmology and was famous for not talking to anybody. And have hours of conversations with him, which I then had to transcribe, which took days, months, actually. I got so sick of it. So I don't record conversations, because then I'd have to listen to them. I take notes.
I always like hearing how people do that, because there are some writers like John McPhee and Lillian Ross who are adamantly against tape recorders. They think they're intrusive and actually not selective because they take everything in. Other people fight the other way. It's just like, you get everything and then you can be selective later as you transcribe and throw out what you need, but at least you've got it all there. So I'm always interested to see how different reporters and writers process that. So
yeah, it depends on what you're there for. And if it's something like for the newspaper, if you have this conversation, the things that you remember from it are probably the most important things anyway. And you've written them down. And you know what? You don't want to get too far down into the weeds. On other occasions, you want to hold complete documentary record of it. Yeah, then somebody will have to deal with it. Actually, anyway, I've been doing more recordings because I can send it off and have it transcribed at a pretty reasonable price, and the Times will pay for it. So,
that's excellent. That, what service do you use?
This freelancer who,
okay,
he was in Canada, and now for some reason she's living in Cyprus, but she's very fast and very accurate. The thing is, then you still get like this multi-page document back that you have to read and find the stuff that you want. But at least you'll, get a very accurate transcription.
Is there a piece of advice maybe when you were 25 you wish someone had told you that just would have maybe, just helped you out as you were say, getting started, or just would have, helped sharpen the knife and made things maybe a little bit easier for you and expedited things?
Well, I just tell you that same thing I tell everybody is it's not over till the fat lady sings, and you just got to keep going. You have to be persistent and just keep reporting out. Just keep asking questions. Never give up. I don't think there's any kind of magical cure for anything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of myself as particularly clever or articulate or charming interviewer or anything. And when I hear other people doing interviews, I feel the same thing. But there's nothing magic. There's just like persistent, constant, careful work.
Yeah, I like that persistent, careful work.
I mean, I think lots of people are more graceful, lyrical writers than me. But I'm stubborn, and I just do it whether I'm talented or not.
Hmm. I guess the last thing I'd ask you is, what still excites you about the work you do, and where does your optimism lie?
God, I don't think anybody ever confused me for an optimist, especially these days. I think it's just because there's so much yet to learn and know and wonder about. We're not running out of mystery.
Yeah. All right. And Dennis, where can people find you online and maybe become more familiar with your work before you get out of here?
Online? I mean, the New York Times?
Mm-hmm. Or like Twitter, your social media, where you hang out online.
Well, I do have a Twitter account at Overby, and I do have a Facebook page that I don't use much. I post pictures on it from every now and then.
Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. Well, Dennis, thanks for carving out an hour of your day and allowing me to get to know you a little more and sort of the person behind the work. So, thanks for the work you do. And I know every time I see a Dennis Overby byline, I'm in for a nice little ride. So thanks for the work you do, and we'll be in touch. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Cue outro. Another CNF pod in the can. Can you believe it? Thanks, CNFers. Got any questions or concerns? You can email me, or you can ping me on Twitter at Brendan O'Mara or at CNF Pod. I'm also at Brendan O'Mara on Instagram and at CNF Podcast on Facebook. There's no shortage of maddening ways to get in touch with your CNFing buddy. I do all kinds of wacky cross-promotional things, so if you're into that, pick a network and follow me. Say hi. I like that. Most important, if you want my monthly reading list newsletter, head over to brendanomara.com and sign up for it. There's a toolbar across the top, and then sometimes there's a pop-up menu that will come up every now and again. It's once a month. No spam. Can't beat that. Unsubscribe anytime. But don't unsubscribe. I like subscribers. It's fun. If you're feeling especially kind, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts /iTunes, as that helps with visibility and validates this entire operation so we can reach as many people as possible in our little corner of the internet.
All right. Sorry I took last week off. That's not going to happen again. No, this week. It'll likely happen again, but not next week. I will be back next Friday for another episode. Have a CNF and great week, friends.